Hello, interwebs, and welcome to Close Up. I'm your host, Joe, and this week's Ryan, Justin, again.
Yay! I'm back. I know, you missed me.
Back for another installment of Leisure Lists, which, to those of you who are regular listeners to this show, you might think, didn't you guys just do a Leisure List last time? And like, two times before that? These things are getting very frequent. Well, the show is still finding its footing with Ryan gone. And in lieu of hour-long review episodes of things now, leisure lists are just going to be more common, especially because those lists keep ballooning and need more space to fill them. So it's better to do them more frequently than give you, like, a Zack Snyder movie every month. So on to the list. I will start off with changing things up a little. Instead of going in chronological order, I will begin by discussing things that I have seen more recently. So, things that may actually be out and current, once again, in lieu of hour-long episodes explaining all these things. So, the other month, I went to theaters to see a documentary, which is kind of weird for me. I don't usually go to theaters to see documentaries. I don't even really normally see documentaries. But this one spoke to me, and I was waiting with bated breath for it to come to my local cinemas at all. So the day it came out, I'm like, oh crap, I'm just dropping whatever I'm doing, and I'm going to rush right out to see Superman, the Christopher Reeve story. As longtime listeners know, Superman the movie is my third favorite movie of all time. Childhood favorite. Superman's my favorite superhero. Christopher Reeve's my favorite version of Superman. And he's a personal hero of mine, too. And I needed to see this documentary about his life. Which, knowing a lot about Christopher Reeve's life as I do, it didn't necessarily teach me anything I didn't already know as a fan, but it put that knowledge alongside stock images and video footage of him and his family and lots of footage I hadn't seen before, which contextualizes it in a visual medium for maximum impact. This is a film about an all-around hero on the silver screen and in real life. Because Christopher Reeve used his status and persona to give hope to hundreds of thousands, push for real societal changes, which would make people's lives easier to live, all while battling his own demons and health, an acting career, and a family life. The accident, which cost him his ability to walk due to a spinal cord injury, ended up turning him into the best version of himself. It magnified his passion and seize the day attitude, and managed to somehow minimize the fears which held him back when he was more able-bodied. And I left the theater inspired and with eyes full of tears. He did so many great things for so many people. So I think this is a watch ASAP. Great documentary. And also, it was kind of cool, just from the very opening, that the new DC Studios logo under James Gunn played just at the top. And it's like the 1940s Superman logo. I'm like, oh, that's pretty cool. Because I heard that James Gunn didn't necessarily have to tie this movie into DC Studios. This was just a documentary they were making about Christopher Reeve. And James Gunn was like, well, you know, I'm writing and directing the next Superman movie, so, like, hell, let's just get Warner Bros. To buy it and make it a Warner release. It's fitting. This is the studio that released the movie in the first place, and we're working on a new Superman project, so let's honor the character's history, the actor's history with our studio, and bring it home. So, that's a pretty cool thing that he got to happen there. Next up, recently I finished Cobra Kai Season 6 Part 2. I'd like to get a little rant out of the way and just very angrily address Netflix and their infuriating decision to split the final season of Cobra Kai into three distinct parts, months apart. They released the first part, I don't even remember how many months ago, 5 episodes. And then they dropped 5 episodes. I think it was about after 4 months, they dropped these ones. And now we have to wait, I think it's another 4 months for the final 5 episodes of the final season. I don't understand this release strategy. Netflix is still, they're still stuck in their old way of doing things of, oh, we have to release a bunch of stuff for people to binge instead of just going based on the old weekly model like Disney Plus or Amazon Prime, where basically everybody else has gone back to, because clearly that system has proven to work for audience retention and keeping projects in the public conversation. I find nobody's really talked about Cobra Kai since 4 months ago when part one of the season comes out. So you lose momentum. I was excited 4 months ago. I'm hyped watching it now. But anyway, what was I thinking of these 5 episodes? All in all, weaker than the first 5. It's a lot of repetition in there and a lot of just melodrama. That's like, well, okay, I thought the whole point of the first 5 episodes was everyone's past all of their petty rivalries, and then they reignite them immediately again in this set. I'm like, all right, I've seen these rivalries a million times in the show already. Can we move forward against the shared bad guys now? But yeah, it all felt sort of contrived and a little bit painful. But all these disparate plot threads with so many characters did eventually tie together for a compelling payoff. Although this show would be less than half the length if they just let some rivalries die. So the melodrama parts were kind of frustrating. But the action was top-tier Cobra Kai. One of my favorites was that scene where Miguel is, there's like a platform high in the air, and the fighters have to combat each other on the tournament, and they have to fall off the platform, they lose, basically. And it was a 2-on-2 fight, and Miguel's teammate, they all fail. So it was Miguel who was 2-on-1, and then he kicks both their asses and he proves himself as the ultimate badass. He really is the legacy of the Karate Kid. You know, everyone, he's sort of the main character of Cobra Kai. I mean, everybody's got a lot of stuff going on. Like, Johnny is the protagonist of Cobra Kai, but Miguel is the real legacy of all these disparate karate styles. He's the ultimate synthesis of everything good about Miyagi-Do and Cobra Kai. And he proves it here. Lots of surprises, too. Like Chosen and I forget the one character's name. They had surprising chemistry there. I like the Iron Dragons. They're a threat that kind of comes out of nowhere in this last season, and I didn't really see them coming, but they're kind of cool. There's a one guy who reminds me a lot of Ivan Drago from Rocky IV, just this unbeatable fighter. He's a considerable threat to the protagonist, so that's pretty cool. Good acting as well, good action scenes. Contrived melodrama, but sometimes you might expect that from Cobra Kai at this point. Just wish it had wrap up sooner that way, that part of it. But yeah, Cobra Kai Season 6 Part 2 is still worth a watch. What you got first?
Well, I'm going to try and stick with your theme of going with something that's a newer release. So it's an audio book. It's called Star Wars Padawan's Pride. Mm-hmm. And so basically it's set around like a 14-year-old Anakin Skywalker being mentored by Obi-Wan. And it's kind of it's a story about their relationship kind of evolving, because this isn't very long after Obi-Wan's technically become his master. So it toes the line of that relationship between them. Are they like brothers, or is he a father figure to him? But it was a really interesting setting, because the whole thing is set around another pod race. So it's Anakin, you know, doing a pod race for the Jedi's purpose. And it's all around. It's pretty good. It's pretty interesting.
It's kind of an unexplored era in Star Wars. Normally, I remember as a kid, there was a series of books that bridged the gap between Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones, that 10 years where Obi-Wan was training a young Anakin. I did read a couple of those at the time, but in Disney canon, there really isn't a heck of a lot set within that era. Disney loves between episode 3 and episode 4. I've seen about a million things there. They also love that period right between episode 6 and 7. I'd say those are their two favorite eras. So to give that post-Phantom Menace era some love is nice to see.
Yeah, and it is Disney canon, this one, as well. I had to double-check that, but it is Disney canon, so it's pretty neat.
Look, to all the Disney haters out there, as much as I disparage Disney Star Wars, they hire writers to tell the best stories they can. Not every project pans out, but a lot of times I'm willing to give it a chance just because look, this writer is just telling an Obi-Wan and Anakin story in this era. And Disney can veto them if what they want to do conflicts with the broader canon. But it's just a Star Wars story at the end of the day. It could be good, and you say it's pretty good. Try not to go into the every Disney era thing with too much bias. They aren't necessarily the architects of everything. If anything, they just say more what you can't do. But just in general, this is just, you know, a writer writing a Star Wars story, for better or for worse. Yeah. So next up for me is another DC thing, which is The Penguin, which, gotta be honest, was not hotly anticipating this show, because as much as I enjoyed Colin Farrell's take on the Penguin in Matt Reeves' The Batman, I didn't necessarily see him as compelling enough to be the lead of his own HBO drama. I was proven wrong. This show is absolutely incredible. Let's just start with the very obvious at the tip of the iceberg here. With the makeup and prosthetics on Colin Farrell specifically, he is unrecognizable under whatever they're doing to his face there. And not just in the visual look of it, but it's his acting as well. He plays Oz Cobb as so different from himself. You'd almost never know it was Colin Farrell if you didn't look at a cast list. He sinks himself so completely into this role. He really, it's incredibly immersive. I very rarely watch this show and I'm like, wow, Colin Farrell is doing a great job. I'm just fully immersed in the character of Oz Cobb and whatever he's doing. He just seems like a real guy, like such a three-dimensional character brought to life through excellent prosthetics and a performance and the writing as well. Because Oz is a character that could be very one-dimensional, but he's very... The smart thing about this show is that he's the underdog in a system that doesn't respect him, looks down upon him as, oh, he's the, you know, he's the penguin, haha, he's the guy with like a, you know, a medical condition on his foot, he waddles, he was just, you know, the mob boss's daughter's chauffeur before he got a chance at the Iceberg Lounge. Like, he's smart, but nobody really thinks of him as smart or takes him all that seriously. So when he starts making plays to be the guy in the mob world of Gotham, the people who are already in charge don't really pay him that much mind until he becomes a problem. But most of this show is just him playing mind games with people, building up a network of allies and pitting his enemies against their mutual enemies. Even though nobody really trusts him, he makes such compelling points. If he was a D&D character, he'd be making ridiculous rolls for persuasion and passing those checks all the time. Even though people should have no reason to trust him, he's incredibly persuasive. But the thing about this show is I don't even necessarily consider Oz Cobb the protagonist. I feel like Sophia Falcone, played by Kristen Milioti, she's the protagonist. What I should say is Oz Cobb is the protagonist, but Kristen Milioti is Sophia Falcone. She's the star of this show. She steals every single scene she's in. I didn't even know anything about Sophia Falcone from the comics, really. I recognize the name. I know she exists. But what Kristen Milioti did with this role is one of, if not the best acting performance I've seen in a project this year. And once again, this is from the same show that I'm praising Colin Farrell so highly. Like, between the two of them, they're just magnetic, individually and together. They both create some of the best on-screen villains I've ever seen. I'll say it. It sounds like hyperbole, but they're that well written and performed. And both of them, I love how complex the characters are, because neither of them are really good people. We're sympathetic towards them for this reason and that reason. We understand why they're doing what they're doing. But at the end of the day, they're both mobsters and both do horrendous things and hurt innocent people. But we still somehow root for them both, even when they're fighting against each other. You're very enticed by the growing mob war in Gotham as well. Like, nobody's innocent in Gotham. That's one of the big things about this show, is that Gotham is just the seediest place on planet Earth, and nobody is really good here. But it's really how much do we respect you and want you to win? The only one who's arguably good is Vic, who's, you know, I'd say for the purposes of this show, he's like the Penguin's version of Robin. He's like the Penguin sidekick in this show, just like this kid who was stealing hubcaps off his car in episode one. And he's like, all right, I'm going to give you a chance. So then he sort of becomes the Penguin's right-hand man. And as the Penguin slowly corrupts him and brings him into this mob world, Vic is sort of the audience's perspective on Oz to see how you could respect a guy like this, shows a softer, more compassionate side to him. Gotham itself is a vibrant character. The cinematography looks very much like the Batman. This feels like an incredibly well-realized and consistent world with what Matt Reeves set up in that movie. So if you were a fan of the Batman, this show is a must because it's a direct continuation of it, picking up right after the events of what the Riddler did in that movie. Weird thing about it, though, is, and I will say, no Batman at all. They mentioned Batman's name in relation to the Riddler crisis at the very start in episode one. And there's a little tease right at the end without actually showing anything heavy implication, though, that this story is going to be setting up the Batman 2 going right into there directly. But Robert Pattinson makes no appearance as Bruce Wayne. Batman's hardly mentioned. And I know a lot of people take issue with that. They're like, well, the more this mob war ramps up, you'd expect to see Batman in here eventually. No, not yet. But I guess we'll see what he was doing during this time in the Batman Part 2. Other than that, I don't really have many critiques of this show. It's very well done in every way you can make a TV show, a limited series specifically. It's only 8 episodes, and I'm just riveted from start to finish in all regards. It's one of the best written shows I've seen this year, one of the best acted, cinematography. It's also a really great crime drama. It's just a gangster show, and we haven't had a great crime drama since Better Call Saul ended. So, watch ASAP. The Penguin's amazing. Just a great show. Not even for Batman fans, necessarily. It's just a great gangster show. And for something completely different, I watched Conclave, which tried not to have too many preconceived notions about this one. I'm not an overly religious person, but it seemed like an interesting premise on paper, which is a bunch of cardinals in the Vatican who the Pope has just died, and all these cardinals have to take a vote on who's going to be the next Pope, which is a very closed doors process. You know, people know the black smoke or the white smoke in Vatican City. Oh, they picked a Pope, but nobody really knows what goes on behind those closed doors. This movie is a fictionalized attempt to show a possible version of that. And it's actually plays out like a mystery nearly, because all these cardinals who are up for the role of Pope have all these scandals behind them that are suddenly coming out in the voting process. So that's one of the reasons that just when they think they have a suitable lead, that guy gets taken out of the running because they discover this or that about him, which would be unthinkable if he were to become Pope for the reputation of the Catholic Church. So Ralph Fiennes is the lead in this movie, and he's exceptional as the lead in here. So there was a continuous sense of mystery in what's going on, and like, why are all these scandals suddenly coming out at this time? Well, there are reasons for that. There are forces playing against each other. They're playing politics at a very opportune moment. There's also factionalism within the church community as well. There's like a very right-wing group who's more fundamentalist religious and don't like the growing tide of liberalism within the church. And then there's the other group that's like, well, we don't want to bring the church back to the dark ages. We have to be more progressive to stay relevant. And these two groups are vying for the papacy as well. And Ralph Fiennes is kind of dead in the middle of this, like having to figure out all these squabbles. And so good acting, great costumes. If I can laud one thing about this movie in particular, it's the great costume design. Some Christians might take issue with a few controversial takes on faith that this movie subscribes to. But it sort of lined up with my own take, so I didn't mind them. What do you have next?
So something else that came out recently was Overlord and the Holy Kingdom. It came out in theaters. I believe it's still in there. There's a couple showings somewhere of it still. I know that, but it's covering a section of Overlord is an anime. There's 4 seasons. There's like 16 books. And this movie covers a portion in between that they kind of glossed over in the anime.
Yeah.
And going into this, I wasn't sure if I was going to go in, like, watch it. Because I just, like, I watched the anime a little bit. You know, it's pretty good. The anime's pretty good. You know, I watched all four seasons just in the last year or so. It's essentially a guy's playing his game, like he's playing an online MMO as it ends, and then he's stuck in it. Well, not really stuck in it. It's like he's stuck in the body he was in, and kind of that stuff goes with him to essentially a new world.
Sure.
That's not a game. So, but he's essentially just like ridiculously overpowered, which is kind of strange to watch sometimes because it's definitely a writing challenge if I've ever seen one. How do you keep it interesting when your character is stupidly overpowered consistently?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And even the author himself has done some interviews and he's like, yeah, I don't know how many people were going to like it because of that. But I think it works. But especially what really sold me was when I went to see the movie, it got me so much more invested in the anime and Overlord itself because it was so good.
Yeah, and you told me that it's not too high a bar for people who haven't seen all that, all the seasons or read the books or anything. It's not bad for new people coming in.
Yeah, not really. Like, they're basically, if they gave one more piece of information, then everybody would be basically caught up on what's actually going on, or you can just watch it and have a twist. But that right. seems to be people who've gone in not knowing anything seem to have a lesser opinion of it. But it is going based off the assumption that you've seen four seasons of an anime, right? But you don't have to know, because really only two or three characters carry over. It's pretty separate, which is, I think, is why they kind of skipped it in the anime, because it didn't really affect anything too much. Like, me not having read the books didn't even notice that, like, there was a slight discrepancy that I was like, huh, I guess they just glossed over this, but that's okay. People who are super fans of the books are like, oh my god, they glossed over like two whole books or something. I don't know. But no, it works really good because most of the cast is new characters, right? And their story is self-contained in this movie. They don't carry on to continue. Like, they stay, like, this kingdom, the Holy Kingdom, which is the title of the movie, is kind of its own separate place. So those characters
right.
stay there. So they don't, you know, you're getting their entire story done in this movie. So it's really good, though.
I think it's interesting to make a movie like this that's not for newcomers, but doesn't alienate them either. Because I feel like too many things that get a movie adaptation try to cater way too hard to newer audiences at the expense of the people who already know what's going on. Half the movies are usually exposition. Like, yes, I know. Let's get to the point. How many people here are newbies who know nothing? So I, you know, like you said, even people who don't know, they come out of this movie having a lower opinion of it, but also it wasn't really for them. And the fact that they're not completely lost seems like a win as a fan of the project. Like, it's a movie for the fans, and I can respect that.
Honestly, I think the one sticking point for people who aren't in it is basically the last scene, which kind of changes things, but not really. The general story you could lop off that end section and it would still be a complete story. That last bit was just for people who were in the know. But some people think that they're like, oh, now I'm really confused, right?
Yeah.
But the whole story is self-contained within the movie.
Cool. So do you remember what trailer you saw while you were at that movie?
I recall, the Wicked trailer, and I don't know, there were so many things that I just, like, I cringed so hard at the trailers. I was very shocked at the state of cinema right now.
Yeah, so I saw Wicked.
Oh, no.
Because, look, there was that weekend where they were trying to recreate the Barbenheimer thing with, what do they call it, Glicked. It was the Gladiator 2 and Wicked Weekend. The two big but kind of weirdly opposing movies coming out on the same weekend. It's not as big as Barbenheimer, but Glicked was a thing. Planned to see Gladiator 2, but the person who was going to come with me bailed because they got sick. Thanks, Mom. So I saw Wicked instead. Because I'm like, you know what, no, fine. I could see Gladiator 2, but my mom's a huge fan of Gladiator, so I'll see Gladiator 2. And I'll review it for the next Leisure List, I'm sure. Wicked. I had no expectations for this, really. I wasn't that enamored by the trailers either. And I've been hearing about Wicked for so many years. I'm like, okay, well, it seems interesting enough. Kind of an origin story for the Wicked Witch of the West. In his musical, sure. I didn't realize until the day before I went that this was technically Wicked Part 1. Not even a full adaptation of the screen of the stage play, but a 2 hour and 45 minute Part 1 that's somehow longer than the actual stage play and only ends at about the stage play's intermission. I don't know how they managed that. Having not seen the stage play, I have no clue. And I will say, I have a lot of positive to say, but I want to get through the negative first. It is really long, and it felt really long, especially the whole third act just felt incredibly dragged out. And I really don't know how they're going to make an entire sequel. I don't know how much material of the plot threads are still dangling left to tell. I'm like, okay, well, just by virtue of having seen The Wizard of Oz and having seen this movie, I'm like, okay, well, I see a few things that you can still set up if you're trying to get right on the beginning of Wizard of Oz. Like, if you want to go that far, I can see some stuff you still have to set up. Okay. But as far as the movie goes, I actually really enjoyed it. I went in with bottom expectations for it. But one thing that actually surprised me about this movie was that I knew more songs than Defying Gravity. I'm like, oh, I actually know a couple of the songs in this movie just from, I don't know, I feel like I heard them in high school. Because I was around, you know, band and glee club people a lot back in high school. And I feel like I heard a couple songs performed back then. No idea what they were from at the time. Never bothered to look it up. But having watched this movie, I'm like, oh, I've always remembered those songs. Some of those ones have been stuck in my head for years. So that's what this is from. All right. So that was a pleasant surprise. I actually really liked the music in Wicked. Very well performed as well. I don't have the actors' names present, but so Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande are the two main characters, which I mean, everyone knows Ariana Grande can sing. The question with her was, could she act? And yeah, she plays Glinda the Good Witch very well. Their chemistry, Ariana and Cynthia's, great chemistry. You believe in this rivalry turn burgeoning sisterhood between the two of them. Basically, they're like, you know, Glinda's the good witch. She wears pink. She's super popular. Everybody loves her. And Elphaba is like, everyone is weirded out by her because of the color of her skin. She's like, she's green, and she has these innate magical abilities that sort of make her dangerous. So everyone's like, eh, you're weird. So, but then they end up having to room together, and they hate each other at first, and then, you know, then they start a relationship, and then there's like a Prince Charming character who just sort of shows up in the area, and he sort of starts stirring the tension at this wizarding school, or just this school in Oz that they're at. And then meanwhile, there's grander problems happening in Oz. I thought it was a really interesting commentary on performative activism, actually, because Ariana Grande's character, Glinda, is like, she talks a huge game about being, you know, an activist and wanting to change the world for the better. But she basically just, and you know, everyone's like, man, you're like, she's Glinda the Good Witch, right? So everyone's like, oh man, Glinda, you're so good. You're so good. You're like, you're amazing. You're such, you have such a big heart. You're so kind. And it was hilarious right away when Elphaba called her out on the BS. It, like, one of the first times was when she's like, when I learn wizardry, I will cure the color of your skin. I'll make you normal. And Elphaba's like, wow, how noble of you to promise something with power you don't even have yet. And everyone thinks you're a hero just for saying you're going to do it. So there was a lot of running themes under the movie like that, which I appreciated in this time of performative activism. I'm like, so many people saying they want to change the world and being applauded for it, and very few people actually putting their feet forward to make the changes they all scream to the hills about. So, yeah, I think it's a relevant movie for the times we're in terms of that. And even going up to the Wizard of Oz himself, who is this grand figure in the world, which, spoilers for an 80-year-old movie, but everyone knows, well, the audience knows he's a charlatan. So, you know, this authority figure who everyone thinks is going to save Oz, and you know, he can't do anything really. He has to rely on the people with actual talent, and he's just a figurehead. So there's a lot of relevance for this story in modern times. And besides all that, I think it's a very it's got the most stunning costumes and set design I've seen this year since Dune. It's like, if it gets nominated and wins Oscars for its costumes and its sets, I would not be surprised. It's very impressive what they managed to pull off. And it looks like it was largely practical sets as well. And the camera work in this movie was incredibly immersive. Just the twisting and turning through the action and the dancing numbers. I'm like, oh, wow, this feels actually kind of interesting, what you're doing behind the camera here. And it's an immersive world. The special effects are really cool. Just little bits of magic casually interwoven throughout the film. There's a lot I liked about it. It was really just the pacing which threw me off, and the length. But content-wise, very good film, actually. And I'm actually excited for part two. So it's worth a watch. So that does it for...
That's very surprising. I thought it wasn't going to be very good, but
you don't really like musicals, so I don't know if I'd recommend it for you. It's like, it's very, very much a, you know, full on musical. So if you're into that, I should say as a caveat, it's not going to turn you into a musical lover if you don't like musicals. But it's a very good musical film for people who are into that.
Me personally, I actually like stage play musicals. But not movie musicals.
Fair enough.
You know, sometimes I wonder with these stage play adaptions if it would just be better to just do a high budget performance of the stage play and dynamic camera angles and record it.
So Hamilton on Disney Plus. And it was like the biggest thing of all of COVID lockdown.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was exactly that. It was just dynamic camera on the stage show.
That is kind of cool. You're going to make me go watch that now.
Yeah. It's like 3 hours long. It's on Disney Plus, but yeah, that's exactly that. Anyway.
That's cool, actually. I didn't know that.
So that does it for stuff I've seen in theaters or on TV lately. So now just the random movies and books and shows I've consumed. Starting with This is 40. Because why not? I thought it had a strong start on this one. Good vignettes of situations one might experience at the age of 40. But the overall pacing in this movie is awful, nay, painful. It's not even a laugh-out-loud funny movie. It's chuckle-inducing at best. Although I liked the tone throughout it. Wasn't too self-serious, which helps. Acting was good. Although I thought the plot hinged too much on characters' lack of communication. I enjoyed the themes of coming to terms with getting older and seeing pieces of your own future, which scares you. Like there's this character's dad who, like, actually they both had, the husband and wife both had problems with their dads, but they sort of start seeing themselves in them as they're, you know, now that they're 40, they're like, okay, I can start to see how I'm becoming you. And I don't like that. And also the themes of feeling like you should be happier in your situation than you are, even if things are going pretty okay. I like the complex emotional relationships, frustrating though they were, as I mentioned. It's also an awkward and uncomfortable movie. So I find it hard to recommend because I feel like it'd be very hit or miss with people, but I thought it was worth a watch. All my criticisms considered. So, what you got?
So I recently finished Demon Slayer Season 3. I know I talked about it before on the last episode, the first two seasons.
Yeah.
Season 3 was really good, actually.
Cool.
Every season's impressed me. Actually, every season seems to have gotten better and better. And I don't know if that's in regards to the fact that, like, the power scaling is going up, so, you know, the fights are more intense and stuff. I don't know if it's because of that or if it's just the storytelling itself.
High stakes conflict is often good for investment.
Yeah, it's still very impressive. This season brought in, like, each season seems to have brought in new characters, and this season's new characters they're really good, so
mm-hmm.
They're enjoyable to watch, and they have their own sort of arc, and the bad guys were really well thought out. And I believe after this there's one more season, and then they're going into a series of three movies, and that's the end of it, I believe. So those movies are one of them supposed to be coming out next year, I believe. So
okay, tune back in a year for that. So I watched Molly's Game, which is based on a true story about this woman who ran poker games. Basically, she started off running poker games for celebrities in Hollywood, and then it ended up where she was hosting games for the Russian mob, and that's what got her into trouble. She was dealing with a lot of illegal stuff, but she managed to do most of this legally for a very long time before she got busted for when she started getting a bit more corrupt. So anyway, a lot of it's based on, I believe it was based on a book she wrote. So a lot of it's from her perspective. criticism I have of the movie is there was lots of exposition dumping. I feel like every other scene was the character Molly explaining the whole context for whatever was happening next. There's lots of exposition. Although I enjoyed the idea that the movie might have an unreliable narrator because this woman we already know has been convicted of this crime and she's retelling her story. So I'm like, well, is she being entirely truthful? You don't know. You just kind of, you can glean as much as you want from her character and what she's telling you and what you're shown. And I believe she was mostly truthful, although I did see a few inconsistencies in her story. But the movie does leave you with questions which you want to see answered later on. It sets up and pays off well. Kept me invested and engaged and rooting for the protagonist. And I thought it was paced pretty nicely for a film on the longer side. Cool subject matter, too. The world of high-stakes gambling. And, it was pretty good. Pretty darn good. Idris Elba was great in it. Kevin Costner, Jessica Chastain. Those are the main cast in it. And they all did very well. Yeah, pretty darn good. The Notebook. Very classic, modern classic romance movie. So I went into this one with pretty high expectations. I feel like I've heard mostly good things about The Notebook, at the very least. I struggled with this one. I was very into it at the very, very beginning. I'm like, oh, you know what? Yeah, it's pretty good dialogue here. I enjoy the conversations, the banter, the costumes, the dreamlike cinematography right from shot one. And it was kind of cool how the cinematography becomes a bit more crystal clear in present day, just to differentiate the time periods. I'm like, the beginning was great. And then it was just this slow downward spiral from the end of act one. Because, okay, look, what I'm going to say about this movie. You know it's a bad romance story when I'm rooting for the other man in the love triangle. I fully wanted James Marsden to end up with Rachel McAdams.
Marsden.
I've only wanted James Marsden to end up with Rachel McAdams instead of Ryan Gosling. Because Ryan Gosling's character somehow doesn't grow whatsoever. There's like decades of time jumps, and he still acts the same as he did when he was a teenager. He's just super obsessive about Rachel McAdams, and that's his entire thing, is this girl that I dated as a teenager. And Rachel McAdams' character devolves into just this entitled brat who's not even that likable. And their romance, despite good chemistry between McAdams and Gosling, is shallow and seems to hurt everybody in their trajectory. I'm just like, oh, this is just painful. I can't even root for the central romance. The frame tale, however, is sweet, and the ending is heartbreaking, but most of the movie is just, I can't root for this romance. It's a romance movie. I can't get behind the whole point. So I think it's still entertaining if you turn off your brain. There is some merit to it, but it's, no, not for me.
I remember it being talked about like it was the greatest romance movie of all time, like, for so long after it came out.
Super toxic.
And it's from what I remember, it's okay. The frame tale was the best part, I think, but...
Yeah.
I think it, yeah. And I'm pretty sure the ending is essentially what it's remembered for at this point.
Great ending. But just the main movie itself left a lot to be desired.
I mean, they could have twisted the frame tale to match what you preferred for the love interest.
Yeah, exactly. They could have.
But they could have done whatever they wanted with it.
Yeah. I've heard the book is better. So, that I haven't read the Notebook book, but I've heard the book handles all the issues better. Anyway, what you got?
I'm going to go into a recent one that... So I watched Arcane Season 1. I know, it's been out for like 4 years. I know nothing about League of Legends. I barely knew anything about this show, just that lots of people really like it, and yeah, I you know, I've seen the main character, or who I thought was the main character, before. I've seen like images of her floating around on the internet. I was like, you know what, I'm gonna try this show. It is gorgeous. It's, I don't know if you've seen it. It's animated. No. It is, like, I swear, 80% of the time, like, you could pause this show and it looks like a painting. It's wow. Beautiful looking. And the, yeah, so the art style is like, crazy good. The storylines so far have been excellent. I just finished season one. I started season two, like, a couple days ago. Yeah, and the characters are all excellent. Like, they're fantastic. I can't think of one character that's bad. Like, I like all the characters, even the ones that you're not supposed to like.
Love to hate.
Yeah, they're great. They're great. Nice. But the world building is very, very cool to me. I don't know if this is... I have no idea how much of this connects to League of Legends, but they've got, like, the upper city, and then they've got the lower city, and, like, there's all these factions in between, and, you know, the council of the upper city, and the world building is so cool with that, though. And it's, like, essentially the main plot is, like, the rising... aggression from the Undercity and new technology being developed in the Upper City.
Okay.
And, like, the Upper City wants to get along with the Undercity, but everybody's kind of got their own clashing ideals, and every character has something different they want. And it's kind of hard to predict where it's going a lot of the times. Not in a bad way. Like, the main lead, Jinx, is very unpredictable. She is a wild card in this show. Who I thought she was the main character. She's not really. She's one of the main characters.
Okay.
But she's like, the second she shows up, you're like, I don't know what's going to happen here, but...
That's nice to be great. Unpredictable.
But it's like, it's very cool. Like, all the characters are so... It builds up the characters so well that when it comes to things, it's almost like when you play D&D and you're like, yes, you played that character correctly. Like, you stuck to the morals of that character in this scenario and watched it flesh out. Like, they act like real people in a way.
You can predict what characters will do because you're like, I know how this character is. You're so distinctive from everybody else. This decision makes sense only for you.
Which is
that's cool.
And that's why sometimes it's hard to predict what's overall gonna happen, because it depends what each character is going to do in that scenario that could change things and really, really affect things. And yeah, it's a must watch. I totally understand the hype behind it. It's excellent. It's fantastic. I don't know if season two is going to hold up, but season one was fantastic. It had excellent from start to end.
Sounds right up my alley. Probably should give that one a try at some point.
And it's not very long either. It's only like, I think there was like 8 episodes. They're like 40 that's minutes, so it's pretty short.
That's reasonable to get through pretty fast. So I watched The Mask of Zorro, which I don't think I've ever seen a Zorro film from start to end. I've seen clips here and there, but I've been very excited to watch The Mask of Zorro for a very long time because I love films in this vein. Classic adventure stories with practical action and stunt work and charismatic actors and relatively simple plots with mature themes. This kind of movie is in the same vein as Indiana Jones or The Mummy or Pirates of the Caribbean. It feels, those are like some of my favorite franchises of all time, and it feels just like that. So with a bit of a, you know, masked hero vigilante flair onto it as well. I like the time period. It's set during the California Gold Rush, and I thought it was interesting what they did with the mythology, because this one features the classic character of Zorro, played by Anthony Hopkins, as he's retired as Zorro. He's old. He's hung up the cape. Well, because he got thrown in prison a long time ago, and he wasn't allowed to retire properly. But then Antonio Banderas is a character who he finds and trains to be the next Zorro, basically. The stunt work in this movie is great. I love the horse chasing sequences and the practical action set pieces, the sword play, the flirtatiousness and romance, and the settings, the grand sets and period costumes and dastardly villain plans, but also pretty simple. They just want to get a lot of gold, basically, out of the gold rush, and they have this plan to make that happen. And Zorro is a hero for the people. It's very, very simple, but just so well done. And it's right in the vein of movies I adore. So I think The Mask of Zorro is a must-see. It's just, I think the world needs more simple but incredibly well-done adventure movies. They're always a great time. So I also watched Mr. and Mrs. Smith, the first movie with, I know there's a show out right now with Donald Glover, but the original one with Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt. This is one of those ones where I remember mentioning this at some point when I talked about Hitch, how marketing from 20 years ago impacted my decision to see this movie today. And it's the exact same thing, because I remember being curious about Mr. and Mrs. Smith ever since I saw the box art on a DVD cover in a Blockbuster about 20 years ago. Just, you know, one of those days when my family's at Blockbuster, just walking through the aisles and like, oh, what movie are we going to rent this week or whatever. And I remember seeing Mr. and Mrs. Smith on there. Too adult for me as a kid at the time, so I guess that's why we didn't rent it. But, like, you know what? I'm going to watch that because I've been curious about this movie for a very, very long time. And I liked how quickly it hit the ground running. There was a brief frame tale, and then boom, right into it. Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt had great chemistry in this movie. They were sexy together, witty dialogue. First half had me. It was an action film equivalent of a failing marriage, and the friends help them take sides, and it's very passive-aggressive till literal weapons are drawn, trying to kill each other. It's nearly like a rom-com of like a marriage falling apart, except they're both spies, and there's literal life or death stakes in their line of work. But neither of them know they're spies until way later on. So it's basically just a story of their marriage falling apart with like a lot of genre tropes that come with that, except they're spies. So it was really cool for the first half. Solid action, really good flow in the editing. The second half is where it started losing me because it got way more cliche, though it was still fun, despite most of the best elements taking a step down. But worth a watch. I had a good time with Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Yeah. That first half especially, though, pretty unique. Good twist on the genre. Next up for you.
Oh, yeah. So I listened to the audiobooks for Jake's Magical Market.
All right.
It's a literature RPG, which, if you don't know what those are, it's essentially take a typical story, but set it, like, cross it over with a video game, essentially. Like, characters go through and they actually be like, oh yeah, I leveled up and stuff, and they gain new abilities. Sometimes they've got, like, UIs and stuff. This is a whole genre of emerging. It's very new-ish. Like, there's a lot out there, but it's pretty new.
Let's do a video game, but like a book.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. And Jake's Magical Market. When I read the first one, I wanted to give the author credit. That I thought he did something really cool. But after reading the second one, I'm not so sure anymore on that. But essentially, the setup is the world kind of has these... I'm going to say it's like... aliens slash gods kind of convert the earth into this game where they all have magic cards that activate spells and stuff. And it's pretty cool for a bit. And then having read a lot of books like this, you can kind of predict where it goes because he's like, oh yeah, I'm going to open a store and, you know, he's running his own little town and
yeah,
selling cards and stuff. And this is like right at the beginning. And you can kind of like... it doesn't seem very interesting. Like, it's interesting enough. But having read enough of these, you can basically predict where it's going. And then it just doesn't. It just goes completely in the opposite direction. And, yeah, it turned out it was pretty good. The first one was excellent. It, after that point where you think that it's going to be exactly what you're imagining... It's just a roller coaster right to the end, and you're like, holy cow, that was certainly a ride. Like, it's pretty, it picks up speed real fast to the end after that point. And it's crazy. So, and I thought the author did some things, but I don't think so. And that's pretty heavy spoiler territory, so I'm not going to mention about that. Then I read the second one, and it was so incredibly slow for the first, like, half, maybe further. And the book version of this book is 600 pages. It's not a small book. So when you're talking, like, 300 pages of it being extremely boring after the first one went on this crazy roller coaster right to the end, and you're like, holy cow, that blew my mind. And then the second one just, like, picks up from the, you know, that craziness of the ending of the first one. And then just, like, he does next to nothing. And you're like, oh, no. And the main character kind of, like, it's like his intelligence stat just, like, dropped significantly. And he makes really bad choices. And you're like, why? I got halfway through it and I had to look it up to see if he would get any smarter or if like if it would get better, and it was like yes it does by the third book, and I'm like, oh, I'm halfway through the second one, I guess I gotta finish it, because they're like, oh yeah, the first half of the second one is terrible. And I'm like, oh great, so I can continue and see the rest. And it, you know, it ended up decently, it picked up in the second half a bit, but nothing near the first one. There's one more. Mm-hmm. I haven't started it yet because I don't have the heart to start it. I'm scared that it's going to be slow again.
Well, consensus seems to be it's okay, based on what you were saying.
Yeah, the first one's excellent. Like, you could go with just reading the first one, too.
Yeah. All right, next up for me is The Negotiator. I knew nothing about this movie going in. So when the movie starts off with Sam Jackson's character being framed for a crime he didn't commit, it looks very, very much like it's just going to be a blatant ripoff of The Fugitive. And then it wasn't that. And I'm like, oh, okay. This is something very different, actually. Okay. So basically the setup for the movie, which, sorry, I'm giving away details I didn't know going in, but effectively what it is he's a hostage negotiator. So once he's framed for this crime he didn't commit, he's framed for killing his partner, who's another cop. So he marches into the police headquarters, and then he takes hostages. So the hostage negotiator becomes the hostage taker in this movie. And having all the insider knowledge of tactics negotiators use, he knows how to play the cops who are in hostage negotiating with him now. So Kevin Spacey's the hostage negotiator who Sam Jackson asks to negotiate with him. And Kevin Spacey's like, why is he asking me? He doesn't even know me. But that's besides the point. So the whole movie is basically Kevin Spacey and Sam Jackson, hostage negotiator versus hostage negotiator. And he's trying to prove his innocence in the middle of this high-stakes situation while trying to get Kevin Spacey and some of the other... Because he doesn't know who to trust. He's like, well, there's a lot of corruption on the police force. Any of these cops who are down here could have been the one who actually killed my partner and are trying to frame me. So I have no idea who to trust here. So that's why he gets Kevin Spacey, because he's an outsider. He has no bearing on the situation. So that's basically the entire movie is this hostage negotiation, which Sam Jackson and Kevin Spacey have way better on-screen chemistry than I might have predicted. The only thing I'll say about this movie, only problem, is that the film lost a lot of tension because of its first act, which establishes very firmly that Sam Jackson is innocent. I think the movie would have been a lot more tense if we were more placed into Kevin Spacey's perspective of, I'm just getting called on a hostage negotiation from this former cop seemingly turned bad. He was like, he was a hero and now he's taking hostages. I don't really know what to think either. But we as the audience already are sympathetic with Sam Jackson because we know he's innocent. But I feel like it that takes some tension away, that we know he's innocent. So all the sketchy things he does in the name of this hostage negotiation, we're like, okay, well, we know he's doing it for a reason, even though it looks like he may be pushing things too far and going into villain territory. But Kevin Spacey doesn't know what to think about him. Still really good, though. They kept the story fascinating, despite it being set in one primary location. The whole thing basically takes place in and around this police headquarters building during the hostage negotiation. And there is some action towards the end, which wasn't the highlight, but it was good. The movie is more about the buildup to the action, which is awesome. The plot was well written, well executed. First act dragged the film out a little, but the rest was pretty darn good. Something different. So then a novel I read, Be Careful What You Wish For by Jeffrey Archer. The thing about this book is I have a lot of books in this house that I live in very poor order. They're just sort of everywhere in boxes. So I pick mostly what I want to read by just grabbing books out of boxes. And I think I've discussed this about previous series in the past, but I didn't realize that this was book 4 out of 7 as I was until I'd already started reading it. So I have no idea who these characters are. It was only in like the first couple chapters in where I'm like, am I supposed to know these people? It seems like the author is writing these things as if I'm supposed to have a little bit of background knowledge on this. Like, they just hit the ground running really fast. I'm like, all these characters have such meaty and three-dimensional and predetermined rivalries and everything. I'm like, this doesn't feel like this is being introduced right now. This feels like a continuation of something. Oh, it's book 4. Got it. I read it anyway. I didn't even look up what happened in the other ones. I just let the book do its exposition for me. I'm like, you know what? I'll figure it out. I don't care. Perhaps because of that, although I don't really think it's because of that, but the plots in this book seemed a little bit random to me. Like, there's a bunch of characters, and they're all doing distinctly different things. Like, it's all about the main characters in this family, but like, I don't know, the father of the family, he's like a best-selling author, novelist, who's trying to come up with his new story. The matriarch of the family, she's taking over the family business and trying to start a luxury shipping line for cruise ships, basically. It's a period piece. It's in the early 60s before this travel industry take, like, they're trying to take their 200-year-old family business and morph it for modern times, but it's a big financial risk. So then the villain of the book is trying to sabotage this whole effort and sink their family's business. So, okay, that kind of was the main draw of it. And then there's the son who's basically just getting like an internship with this banker. And then there's the daughter of the family who's just like an up-and-coming painter going to art school. And I'm like, they're all good. All these characters are very well written and they have good family dynamics and they've all got stuff going on. I'm interested chapter by chapter, but what's the point of this book? I don't really see any of these connecting at all. Like, everyone's just doing their own thing. Eventually, the threads weave together in a cohesive way. It all ties together way late into it. But you have to have a lot of patience with it. Like, okay, this chapter of the book has absolutely nothing to do with anything else. It might pay some lip service to it. Like, hey, yeah, while I'm dealing with this bank internship, I know mom's dealing with this, you know, dealing with the family business perhaps collapsing. I'm kind of dealing with that ever so slightly, but I'm mostly doing my own thing. So, yeah, you gotta be patient, but it does all pay off, and I thought it was very well written. It's worth a read, but maybe read the other 3 first if you want full context. I was fine with just the exposition did a surprisingly good job of catching me up. I understood most of what was happening contextually just by reading this one, so I was impressed with it just for that. Yeah.
So, I don't remember if I talked about this on the last one or at all. I'm a big Jules Verne fan, and I read Around the World in 80 Days. It's good. It's great. It's very good. It's typical Jules Verne. Actually, it doesn't go as in-depth as you would expect from Jules Verne. Usually he goes on these like really long rants about useless information, which is really common. It's like padding the runtime, basically. But Around the World in 80 Days didn't seem to do that as much. Maybe it was because it was more relevant, like talking about the cultures of these countries that they were traveling to. But it was, the characters were all fun. It's a super fun adventure. What really surprised me was the fact that everybody thinks of Around the World in 80 Days, like, you know, if you know nothing, you only know that there's a balloon in it, right? There's no balloon in it.
Yep. It shocked me when you first told me that. I'm like, what? Yeah. The story is only known for the balloon, has no balloon?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a Disney invention, apparently. But, yeah, that caught me off guard because consistently there's a timer, right? They're on a bet. They got 80 days to go around the world. Exactly. The main character is really, he's funny because he's this old guy who's like super timely. He's got everything down to the second. He's like, we can do it. And nobody believes in him. And it's great. But so as the 80 days are going down, I'm like, where's the balloon part? When are they going to do the balloon part? Oh, we got like 2 days left. I'm like, okay, is there going to be a balloon? We got like 2 hours left. I'm like, how are they going to get a balloon in 2 hours? Where's the balloon part? And there's just no balloon part. So that was...
Well, it kept you guessing.
It's good.
Yes. Well, where's the balloon? Anyway. So I read Justice League, Endless Winter by Andy Lanning, Ron Mars, Howard Porter, and Marco Santucci. And I thought a lot of the coloring in this book was a misfire for me. The colors bled too much into each other for my taste. That's some art critique, but the story, thought it was dragged out. Basically, what it happens is the world gets enveloped in a continuous ice storm, effectively. He's like this Viking who had ice powers, who, like, it kind of flashes back and forth between modern day and 10th century BC, where Wonder Woman's mother, this Viking character, I don't remember his name, and Black Adam, they teamed up to fight this guy centuries ago. And then they imprisoned him, and now he's back, and the world's in endless winter. And then it's just the Justice League trying to pick up all the pieces, despite these, like, ice monsters just constantly showing up. No matter how hard they fight, they just keep, it's like the Hydra problem. They take out an ice monster and more keep showing up. It's just, they're just sort of, their endurance is just depleting the longer this problem happens, and they can't find the Ice King no matter what they do. It was an okay story. It was just, it didn't need as long as it took to tell it was the problem. I'm like, okay, I get it. There really isn't much momentum issue per issue here. It still feels like the same status quo, but a little different issue by issue. And the problem with the storm was every issue describes it as sounding super awful and destructive, but it wasn't even shown to be that debilitating for average people outside of these ice monsters. I'm like, okay, so people are trapped in their homes and, like, it's like having a really bad snowstorm. You know how bad that can be. But people are like, even in the parts of the world where they don't normally get snow, nobody's shown to be especially fazed. They don't really show that part of it. They mostly just stay around, you know, northeastern United States or whatever, where people would have winter gear. I'm like, why don't you go to, like, I don't know, Africa or something, where they're not used to snow. We never saw any of that. I'm like, what about all these people probably freezing to death now that the world's in winter? Like, they never really covered that at all. Like, so many more people probably died in this than the story's making it out to be. This would be a way worse catastrophe than the book is actually showing. I thought Black Adam had an interesting role in it. Where he's sort of contemplating his sins of the past. The story also was weird because it shoehorned a few character stories in, which didn't seem to mesh with the threat too well. Just like, I don't know, the world's going to crap, and like Barry Allen is just like contemplating about like whatever problems were going on in his normal series. I'm like, what's this? Is weird. This just kind of feels out of place. But you know, it's kind of cool if you turn off your brain. So I also listened to Dimension 20, Escape from the Blood Keep. This one I had a little trouble with, because the first season of Fantasy High that I listened to, I know Dimension 20 is a very visual show. Podcast form was not its intended medium. So despite that, I still followed Fantasy High pretty well. I feel like I mostly knew what was happening at all times with that. But Escape from the Blood Keep was only 6 episodes. And it was just, I don't know, I had a tougher time telling what was going on. It moved, the pacing was good, but I feel like I also needed to like read people's lips, because there was a lot of audio effects on it, especially on Brennan's voice a lot of times. They put these like low and rumbly audio effects on it. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, I'm having a tough time understanding you, but if I was like seeing your face, that'd probably be okay. And the other reason I feel like it was harder was because it's like half the length of Fantasy High, and a lot, like Fantasy High was a lot more expository. So even if I'm missing stuff, I'll get caught up if I just keep listening and figure it out. But this one was like, they never took a pause for a long rest or anything. It just, from episode 1 through 6, they're just blitzing the entire time. So you really have to be fully engaged to pick things up. Otherwise, you're going to miss stuff. So my review of The Escape from the Blood Keep might not necessarily be the most fair, because I'm not watching it in its intended medium. But I still enjoyed the story for what it was. I like seeing these crew members play villains, even though most of their villainous behaviors was expository and they didn't actually come across that bad in the game. But that was sort of the joke of it. Like, they are, for all intents and purposes, normal people, just people with high positions of power in this evil empire. So, like, yes, they are capable of atrocities, but they mostly just come across as, like, friends who just happen to be, like, lieutenants in this evil army. So that was kind of a cool contrast between their supposed deeds and who they actually are on a day-to-day basis. They're not monsters day-to-day. Some good twists and action in there. Clever choices by the PCs. And I really liked the idea that because none of them really got any long rests, the whole 6 episodes is every, like, especially for the spellcasters, just burning through their stuff. They had to be very choosy about when they were using their spells, because they weren't getting them replenished in 6 whole episodes of a Let's Play. So the stakes were continually high. The characters were really fun. Good story, good performances. Loved seeing Matt Mercer in a playing role for a change. He was the big guest star on that one. I loved his character, Leland. Probably my favorite one in that season. So yeah, Escape from the Blood Keep. Pretty good. Would be better visually, though. Yeah. So that's that.
Okay, this is going to be an interesting one. I played Doki Doki Literature Club. This game, some people might be judging me right now if they know what it is, vaguely. It looks like a cutesy anime dating sim, We got this game on PlayStation Plus for free. the other month or something. And none of the other game, the other games were all horror games, and I always try to play one a month. So I'm like, you know what? Fine, I'll try this game. I was wrong. The theme was horror games. This is its surface is this cutesy anime dating sim. It's not. It's actually traumatizing. This is not. It's not for the faint of heart. It breaks its own rules at times. The story is just some. There are some points in the story where you're just like, I can't keep playing this right now. Like, this is the first time I've ever experienced why people like horror movies and horror games and stuff. You get pleasure from pain. I've never really understood it. This game, I kind of understood it. But there was a part, going into it not knowing anything about it, there was a part that I had a split second where I thought I was going to throw up. It was just, it was so, like, brutal. Especially for, like, I used to do a lot of reading, and I do a lot of audiobooks, and, you know, I love storytelling, so I get really invested into characters, and this game kind of broke me for a while.
I think you told me once that even just listening to the score nearly made you throw up.
It causes a reaction listening to. I can't hear it. It's brutal. It's absolutely brutal. Maybe not everybody would experience that, but I went into it completely blind and being like, oh, you know, it's just, I'm like, okay, whatever. You know, I wasn't taking it that seriously, but I was getting invested in the story, and this game just goes off the rails. It's kind of bonkers.
I remember you told me that, speaking of not taking it seriously, that when the game first boots up, it's like, oh yeah, there's a trigger warning. Oh well, you know, this game contains some pretty, you know, difficult subject matter. Be warned. Okay. And then there's more trigger warnings once you go past that. And then there's more past that. And you're like, whoa, this seems like overkill. Let me just play the game. I can take it.
Yeah, it was basically the first, after a while of shock, I'm like, this is the first time I wish I listened. Maybe wish I listened to the trigger warnings at the top. Like, I just couldn't believe that there was like three layers of warnings to go into this game. And I'm like, what is this? Like, what?
Doki Doki Literature Club. Does this seem like a game for trigger warnings of this caliber?
Doki Doki means heartbeat in Japanese. It's turning into a horror game. Yeah, and it's the other kind of heartbeat. Yeah, it makes sense. It's
goes from like a romantic thing to a scary thing. Yeah.
If you're a person who gets invested in stories and you want to kind of challenge yourself like that, definitely play this game. It's fantastic. It's very, very unique. I've never seen anything like it for the game itself, because it's a visual novel essentially, but it does some things that are extremely unique that I've never even seen anything remotely close to it in a game before. Like, this game was wild. So definitely play it if you can handle it. Don't come back to me and say that I didn't warn you, though.
You didn't warn me, and neither did all the trigger warnings right up top. I didn't believe any of it. Yeah. All right. So, call back to earlier when The Notebook was a supposed modern classic romance movie. Very much disappointed me. I watched another modern classic romance movie. Complete opposite effect. Brokeback Mountain is as good as they say. personally, it's not just a good gay romance movie, but one of the all-time best romance movies I've ever seen. Because what I especially enjoyed was the story shows not merely why the couple works together. That is, you know, that's the very bare minimum you need to do is why is this couple so good together? This story does that, but it also shows how dreadful their lives can be when they're apart. What the absence of their romance costs them as human beings. And I think that's a side of romance. It's a darker side of romance that I feel like a lot of movies I've seen don't touch. Usually they're more about the, you know, the happiness of romance. But it's like, no, being these guys being apart, that having that love ripped out of their lives mutually has a very strong impact on who they became as human beings and spilled over into every other aspect of their, like the trauma created by this romance or lack thereof was very shaping to them as human beings and the people in their lives. The film effectively shows up their pent up rage and their fears about this forbidden romance that they have, because they have, you know, they do have wives and children and personal lives outside of each other, but it, you know, basically they go on a ranching expedition as young men and end up falling for each other on this expedition, and then they go back to their personal lives and they end up moving pretty far away from each other. But they agree to meet up for quote unquote fishing trip as often as they can, get away from their families, just be together. And a lot of times when they come back, it's like, you know, it's paradise. Hey, you know, I'm finally seeing what I've been missing when I'm not with you. But then they go back home and have to deal with the lives they've created apart from each other. And they're just sort of, Heath Ledger's character in particular has especially all this pent up rage about what he's missing. And that starts tearing his family apart because he really can't handle the situation that he's in. And I like the film doesn't excuse how poorly they treat their wives and kids, but also allows the audience to understand why they act the way they do, even if their families don't know. Like, they just see, like, Heath Ledger's character specifically, they just sort of see him as, you know, this jerk of a father figure, which, you know, especially this being a period piece, I didn't realize it was a period piece until I watched it. I thought, like, oh, maybe it is just set in the mid-2000s, but, like, I watched it like a month ago, but I think it's set in the 60s, which is even 60s and 70s, which is even more, oh yeah, like being gay back then is even worse than in the mid 2000s. So it shows, it doesn't just posit them as tragic heroes. It's also like, no, these guys are very flawed. And just because you lost this romance and you have to hide parts of yourself, like, I understand why that makes you aggressive sometimes and very angry, but also doesn't excuse the way you behave because of that pent up anger. So it's like, it's very three dimensional that way. It shows what it costs them and also lets you see it from all sides, basically. Just who these people are. The writing, the acting, the filmmaking, the themes, all the characters felt, what I'm getting at is the characters felt like three-dimensional people with a very, like, this romance is sort of the central thing in their lives, and a lot else, everything else sort of stems from it, but it's just, it's very well done. This is a great romance movie. And for something completely different, a Batman comic, Batman, The Cowardly Lot. by, well, let's see who. Let me find the page. Batman, The Cowardly Lot by, where is that page? Let me see it. By James Tynion IV and Jorge Jimenez. Sorry, butcher the names. And Tomoe Mori. I thought this had an enticing frame tale, which made me question how Bruce ended up in this scenario where he's effectively under the Scarecrow's thumb. He's like, he's captured by the Scarecrow and the Scarecrow's injecting him with fear toxin, and like Bruce is basically broken with reality in this case. And if I recall, I don't think that even fully resolves in this book. That'll come in a future volume that I haven't read yet. But as for most of the story, this takes place after the Joker War, where Bruce Wayne has lost most of his fortune and he's dealing with not being poor, but he's a stripped down Batman right now. He doesn't have his fanciest gadgets anymore. He's a little bit more back to basics right now. But he still has some companions helping him out, like Barbara Gordon is Oracle. Harley Quinn's helping him out now. And I talked about this character, Ghostmaker, on a previous Leisure List. So Ghostmaker's part of the supporting cast now. And I like that they're maybe setting up some flirtations with him and Harley Quinn. Both these like kind of crazy vigilante types. They have a bit of common. I wouldn't have seen that as a potential romance, but I'm like, you know, yeah, these two are actually kind of well suited. And I thought Harley was used well. I also like the well-meaning Mayor Nakano getting suckered into bad decisions out of desperation. Basically, the plot of this book is Scarecrow's master plan is to make Gotham afraid. Like, just he wants to push Gotham City over the brink of fear without even doing anything. He's mostly making them scared with the threat of doing something. And everyone's like, well, okay, but Scarecrow isn't using his toxins. He isn't, like, actually attacking. But he's got the city so anxious something's going to happen that it's causing a lot of problems. So he's winning by doing nothing, and it's infuriating for the heroes. Because they're still just trying to figure out what the heck is going on. I think the book feels politically poignant because of that. Just like the fear-mongering that we see in our society today, where people can be pushed to the brink just from fears of what might happen. Just that kind of fear driving people. Like, well, you'd better do something because this might happen. And that actually pushes people to action. It's, whoa, things actually haven't happened yet. Can we chill out? But that's what's happening in our society today. As for the art, vibrant colors contrasted with the darks of Gotham. Certain characters, new characters like Miracle Molly really illustrate this. She's like super vibrant, but Gotham City is generally pretty dark. Pretty darn good volume of Batman. Quite enjoy it. Looking forward to seeing where this Scarecrow story goes. I mean, I know it's a couple years old, but I haven't read it yet, so. And that is our Leisure Lists. And,
Woo, we made it!
This is probably... We did it. This is probably... I'm going to retroactively make a note here and say that this is going to be an episode that's going to be split in two again. We're going to run the outro twice. Where can we find you?
You can find me at JChurchTPM on Instagram and ThoughtPlane Media on YouTube.
And you can find me on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook at ThoughtPlane Media. Also, check out the Close Up with Ryan and Joe Facebook page for latest updates on the show. If you listen to us in audio, check out our YouTube channel. And if you're on YouTube, find us anywhere you get your favorite podcasts. We hope to see you on the next Close Up with Ryan and Joe with part two of this leisure list. Thanks again, Justin, for coming out. Till next time.
Take care.